For the past several weeks, the Russian army has brutally invaded Ukraine. Throughout these weeks, cities, along with both military and civilian targets across the country, have become subjected to devastating Russian missile and air attacks raining down from the skies. Across major Ukrainian cities, home to millions of people like Lviv, Kyiv, and Kharkiv, the chilling sounds of air raid sirens have begun sounding alarm to residents for the first time since World War II. While thousands have been forced to take shelter beneath the ground in increasingly packed metro stations, scenes eerily reminiscent of Britons in the London Tube throughout the German Blitz campaign of 1940. And just like for months during that era, the battle for control of the skies over Ukraine is ongoing, with neither side so far being capable of achieving complete air superiority, even though the Ukrainian Air Force is overall badly outgunned. The Russian Air Force possesses around 11 times as many fighters, 24 times as many dedicated attack or bomber craft, and roughly 13 times as many helicopters as the Ukrainian Air Force has got. In a longer war of attrition, with all things else being equal, the Russians simply have the numbers to continue sustaining heavy losses in the air, while the Ukrainians do not. And so the math for eventual air superiority is on the Russians' side. And once air superiority is achieved, the likelihood for a Kremlin victory in some form or another increases dramatically. Therefore, throughout the agonizing weeks of this war, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, along with numerous Ukrainian civilians and diplomats, have pleaded with the West, America, and NATO to assist the country by ordering a total closure of the skies above to Russian warplanes. A no-fly zone.
To create a no-fly zone over Ukraine.
Sanctions now!
The accurate description of what people mean by a no-fly zone is actually an aerial combat zone.
Basically, a no-fly zone, if people understood what it means World War III.
Because if an American pilot shoots down a Russian pilot, that's a declaration of war.
Many parliaments within NATO-allied countries of Eastern and Northern Europe, like Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Slovenia, have all called for the no-fly zone to be established. But despite all of these urgent requests, poll after poll carried out across countries in Western Europe have consistently shown low support among the general Western European public for a no-fly zone over Ukraine. However, the same cannot be said of the American public, where several polls there have shown consistently high support for one throughout the invasion, like a poll from Reuters on the 4th of March that showed 74% of Americans supported the implementation of a no-fly zone, a CBS poll from the 11th of March that found 59% of Americans supported one, and a Quinnipiac poll from the 16th of March that found nearly 1 in 3 Americans still disagreed with President Biden's decision to not impose one. But despite all of this public pressure within, and the mounting pressure coming in from NATO allies, and the Ukrainian government and civilians, President Biden and NATO have thus far continuously resisted these pleas, and steadfastly refused to implement the no-fly zone over Ukraine. And they are unfortunately correct to continue doing so. And these are all of the many reasons why. Despite the apparent fact that many Americans are in favor of the no-fly zone, I'd also wager that most of those Americans don't really understand what a no-fly zone actually means. It means setting up a zone, in this case the entirety of the airspace above Ukraine, and then demanding that no flights from anyone take place through that zone. The biggest danger with declaring a no-fly zone like this is what happens after the declaration, because the declaring power must be willing to enforce it. If Russian jets decide to ignore the demand and continue their operations, then it means that NATO and American jets must fly in and engage them, potentially resulting in aerial battles between American and Russian pilots, with the high chance for casualties taking place on either side. In the past 30 years, America and its allies have declared 4 of these no-fly zones with various results. A northern and southern no-fly zone in Iraq leading up to the Gulf War and the 2003 US invasion, a no-fly zone over Bosnia in the mid-1990s, and another over Libya in 2011. In each of these cases, the United States utilized its vastly superior air force and conventional military capabilities to enforce its will in the skies against opponents who could offer up little resistance. Saddam's Iraq, the Republika Srpska proto-state in Bosnia, and the Serbian government, and Gaddafi's Libya. In the most recent no-fly zone that was declared over Libya back in 2011, American and NATO warplanes managed to completely alter the course of the entire Libyan civil war that was going on against Gaddafi by denying his forces any access to the skies and bombing his strategic positions on the ground. And NATO didn't lose a single plane throughout that entire operation because they were overwhelmingly more powerful. But a no-fly zone over Ukraine would be inherently different from all of these, because Russia possesses far, far more capabilities to retaliate than any other target of an American no-fly zone has before. Despite Russia's military setbacks in Ukraine, the Russian armed forces are generally still considered to be the second most powerful in the world behind the United States, with the second highest number of ballistic missile submarines in service, and one of only three militaries worldwide that operate strategic bombers. But the greatest military asset that Russia possesses that none of those other regimes in the past did is a lot of nuclear weapons. In fact, Russia has at its disposal the single largest nuclear arsenal in the world, with approximately 6,000 total warheads. For the sake of comparison, the United States has only around 4,000 warheads, and of all the nuclear weapons in the world combined, Russia owns nearly half of them. Of critical importance to understand, however, these 6,000 warheads can be divided into two different categories: strategic arms and tactical arms. Strategic nuclear arms are the big, scary ICBMs that you usually think about from the movies that fly on top of a missile fired from a silo or a submarine that are powerful enough to destroy an entire city. The point of strategic nuclear weapons like these, though, is to never actually use them. They're only there for deterrence, to dissuade the enemy from ever being tempted into using theirs. And thus, they guarantee mutually assured destruction if one side ever deploys them. From the perspective of the Kremlin, however, tactical nuclear arms are viewed very differently. These are significantly less powerful and destructive nuclear weapons, with only a fraction of the power of the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima, that can be fired from artillery, rocket launchers, or even planes onto a battlefield. They are explicitly designed to be used as a more restrained or limited option by an army to meet battlefield objectives, and critically, the Russian military defense doctrine currently approves of their use in the armed forces under certain conditions, like covering a major retreat operation. Out of Russia's total arsenal of 6,000 nuclear warheads, it's believed that around 2,000 of them are these kinds of smaller tactical nukes. And the centerpiece of this Russian strategy of battlefield nuclear deterrence is the Iskander-M, a mobile missile launcher that can fire either conventional or tactical nuclear warheads at a range of roughly 500 kilometers. And prior to the invasion of Ukraine, satellite images revealed these exact Iskander missile batteries deployed by Russia inside of Belarus with unknown payloads, but with the range to strike nearly every major target inside of Ukraine. This doomsday arsenal must be taken into consideration when deciding on a no-fly zone over Ukraine, because sending in NATO and American jets to shoot down Russian planes who violate the no-fly zone would only really be the beginning of the operation. In order to keep their own planes safe, a no-fly zone would also likely entail NATO airstrikes on Russian air defense and support targets down on the ground, like airfields, surface-to-air missile or SAM batteries, and radar facilities. However, not all of these targets would be limited to the ground within Ukraine. Some of Russia's more advanced SAM batteries, like the S-400, have a range of 400 kilometers, meaning that they could cover wide swaths of Ukrainian airspace from behind the borders inside of Russia or Belarus. Neutralizing them would necessitate bombing targets on the ground inside of Russia or Belarus itself. And thus, it shouldn't really come as any surprise then that Putin has stated that any attempt by the United States or NATO to impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine would be effectively treated as the United States and NATO directly entering the conflict. Ordering a no-fly zone over Ukraine will therefore dramatically escalate the chances of a hot war between Russia and Belarus on one side and the United States and NATO on the other. And when you consider that NATO vastly overpowers Russia in nearly every single category of military capabilities, except for nuclear, it's not inconceivable that if the Kremlin felt they were being backed too far into a corner, they might choose to authorize a smaller-scale tactical nuclear strike somewhere in a last-ditch effort to turn the tide. And it's impossible to predict how things could hypothetically escalate from there. But it's not just the enormous risk of escalation towards a third world war in Europe that makes the no-fly zone unfeasible. Even if one were to be declared, it's unclear how helpful it would actually be. Many of the Russian airstrikes that have hit targets across Ukraine have been missiles fired from planes flying within Russian airspace that never left or entered Ukrainian airspace, which a no-fly zone over Ukraine would not protect against. And that's besides the point that the overwhelming, vast majority of the damage that the Russian military has been inflicting on Ukraine has come from ground-based artillery and missile attacks, which, again, a no-fly zone on its own would not be designed to prevent. Back in the 1990s, when NATO imposed a no-fly zone over Bosnia, it initially did very little to prevent Serb forces on the ground from carrying out highly destructive artillery strikes, and thus, a frustrated and pressured NATO gradually expanded the scope of their aerial operation towards bombing Serb targets on the ground. This exact situation could end up playing out in Ukraine as well, against ground-based Russian artillery and missile systems. And thus, NATO could find itself dangerously expanding the scope of the operation very quickly. And finally, unlike the Serbs or Saddam or Gaddafi, the Russians also possess a very capable and powerful navy with highly capable long-range strike abilities. Back in 2015, a flotilla of Russian warships operating within the Caspian Sea fired 26 cruise missiles towards Islamic State targets across Syria, more than 1,000 kilometers away. Hypothetically, these same ships operating within either the Caspian or the Black Sea could initiate cruise missile strikes into Ukraine from hundreds of kilometers outside of the boundaries of any hypothetical no-fly zone, which could lead to a situation where, once again, NATO may have to consider attacking Russian naval assets outside of the parameters of the no-fly zone in order to fully prevent attacks coming from the sky and dramatically risk escalating to the brink of nuclear war. So, with all of this being said, a no-fly zone over Ukraine would offer only limited help to Ukrainian forces on the ground, while dramatically increasing the risks of apocalyptic military confrontation between NATO and Russia. And so, that's generally why Biden and the majority of NATO have decided that it simply isn't worth the risk, and are unlikely to change their minds. But there are other potential methods that NATO can employ to help Ukraine defend their skies. Earlier in March, Poland, a NATO ally directly bordering Ukraine, offered to transfer 28 of their older Soviet-era MiG fighter jets to the United States and Germany, who would then hopefully transfer them over to the Ukrainian Air Force and replenish the Polish Air Force with a set of newer F-16 fighter jets. However, this too is something that the United States eventually declined to do, out of fear of risking further escalation with Moscow. But there are other things that America has done to support the Ukrainian war effort a bit more indirectly. Following President Zelensky's emotional speech to the United States Congress, Washington announced a further $800 million security package for Ukraine, which will further add to the plentiful anti-air and anti-tank weapons that have already been provided, including around 800 Stinger shoulder-fired anti-air launchers. Simultaneously, Turkey, another NATO ally, has already sold several dozen of their very capable aerial drones to the Ukrainian military as well. Regardless of what kind of help is given by the governments of NATO, the civilians and children that are there on the ground and suffering right now are in dire, absolute need of some kind of help from someone. It's estimated that there are at least 7.5 million Ukrainian children who are now in grave danger of physical harm, severe emotional trauma, and displacement. And while NATO will not be ordering a no-fly zone for all of the reasons that I just covered, there's a lot that everyday people like you and I can still do to help right now. This video has a fundraiser attached to it going towards Save the Children Ukraine, who have been in the area ever since 2014 when Russia first invaded Ukraine and annexed Crimea. They have the highest rating of 4 out of 4 stars on Charity Navigator, and they're there on the ground near the Ukrainian border right now, providing civilians and children with life-saving assistance as they flee the horrific violence happening all around them. I will be personally matching all of the donations made to this charity up to $10,000, including every cent of AdSense that this video generates. And even if you don't have any spare money that you can afford to give, there's still something that you can do as well to help for free by visiting this video sponsor, Tab for a Cause, and installing their browser extension, Tab for Ukraine, which also supports the same charity, Save the Children Ukraine. The extension will show small ads on the bottom of your new tab page that are paid by advertisers, and then the money that is generated from those ads will go towards Save the Children Ukraine. It's that simple, and to prove they're legit, their website is completely open source and they publish quarterly financial reports showing exactly where all of the money goes. So far, they've raised more than $1.3 million for worthy causes, and if you want to start helping, all you've got to do is download the extension and just continue using the internet like normal. Just click the button that's here on screen right now, or follow the link that's down below in the description to head straight there. And as always, thank you so much for watching.